90.7 on your FM dial. Reality used to be a friend of mine. Reality used to be a friend of mine. Reality used to be a friend of mine. Please don't ask because I don't know why, but reality used to be a friend of mine. I used to be friends with reality. She used to be a pal real close to me. But she tried to hide from me what was in store. Tried to house me, but a house has doors. I was insane and the picture was crazy. So the relevance here seems to be a bit hazy. But I try to explain this in the simplest terms.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Please stay tuned for Veterans Voice.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the third annual What the Festival, June 20th through 23rd in Duver, Oregon. What the Festival is an annual electronics festival which this year features the Glitch Mob, Washed Out, Nightmares on Wax, and more. There will also be a hookah lounge, relaxation huts, and the largest disco ball on the West Coast. Again, that's What the Festival, June 20th through 23rd at the Wolf Run Ranch in Duver, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in to KBOO for the 27th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival. KBOO will again broadcast the entire festival from noon to 10 p.m., July 3rd through the 6th. The broadcast will also be carried by various stations of Oregon Community Media for statewide coverage of this Oregon Food Bank Benefit Festival. Again, July 3rd through the 6th, noon to 10 p.m. each day here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And good morning, it's 9:01. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Here's what we've got coming up for you this morning on KBOO. First, it's Veterans Voice. The guest is Lisa Leitz, the author of Fighting for Peace, Veterans and Military Families in the Anti-Iraq War Movement. And at 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, more analysis of what led up to the current fighting in Iraq. Also, the Electronic Intifada, hosted by Nora Barrows-Friedman. At 11 o'clock on the Radio Zine, we hear artist and blogger Danielle Crissa talking about her new book, Creative Block, Get Unstuck. Discover new ideas, advice, and projects from 50 successful artists. And at 11:30, the Beehive Design Collective talks about the final image in their trilogy about the globalization in the Americas. Focusing on resistance to mega infrastructure projects that they are literally paving the way for free trade agreements and devastate local economies and communities. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member today, you can become one easily by going to kboo.fm and clicking where it says donate. Thanks a lot for doing that. And now we're going to start off the show, the programming this morning with Veterans Voice.
We bomb everywhere, man. We bomb everywhere. Way more than our share, man. We bomb everywhere. We bomb the mountains bare, man. Found the desert air. Oh boy, don't we care, man. Cause we bomb everywhere. We've bombed in Peru, Panama, Pakistan, Yemen, Libya, Laos, Syria, Sudan, Congo, Cuba, Korea, Kuwait, Colombia, Cambodia. Ain't we great? Grenada, Nicaragua, Guatemala, Vietnam, Yugoslavia, El Salvador, Afghanistan, Japan, Bosnia, Somalia, Indonesia, Iraq, China, Iran. Time to attack, yeah, we bomb everywhere. Way more than our share. Don't think we ain't fair, cause we'll bomb everywhere. We got family values and moral majority. Peace, love, Jesus, top priority. Do unto them for they do unto us. The kingdom come in nuclear dust. Monumental profits are being made for the big shareholders in the old arms trade. They lust for the dust of a mushroom cloud. It's making them all American proud. Yeah, heat seeker, bunker buster, daisy cutter, napalm, phosphorus, uranium, smart bomb, A-bomb, predator, prowler, raptor, raven, tomahawk, hellfire, flags are waving. We bomb everywhere, way more than our share. Oh bomb everywhere. Our vision of peace has become a ghost, but we're number one, we bomb the most. Soldiers coming home, suicidal, we sit and watch. American Idol, Saudi, Serbia, Mexico, Kosovo, Romania, Germany, load them up, here we go, another verse. Life gets worse, just watch your show and wait for the glow. Well, someday soon we'll all have nukes, true world democracy. Extermination of all life, high possibility. Well, ask your child what they suggest to prevent mass destruction and bring this world in line with love and a brotherhood connection. De-escalate your mental state, incinerate your tools of fate. Build no more weapons or rejuvenate our planet's fate. Drop food, medicine, clothes and tools the children wish you'd see. That will win most the hearts and minds before you count to three. Then we'll bomb everywhere, man, way more than our share. Don't think we ain't fair, man, cause we'll bomb everywhere. We'll bomb in Peru, Panama, Pakistan, Yemen, Libya, Laos, Syria, Sudan, Congo, Cuba, Korea, Kuwait, Colombia, Cambodia. Ain't we great? Grenada, Nicaragua, Guatemala, Vietnam, Yugoslavia, El Salvador, Afghanistan, Japan, Bosnia, Somalia, Indonesia, Iraq, China, Iran, time to attack.
Welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, and 100 FM Albany, Corvallis, Eugene, or streaming on the World Wide Web at KBOO.FM. And if you want to hear some of our past shows, you can go to KBOO.FM/Veterans Voice, one word, and you can hear some of our past shows. I'm Marvin. I'm here with Mr. Bill.
Good morning.
And with Angie.
Hello.
And today we're going to be talking with Lisa Leitz. She's written this book, Fighting for Peace, Veterans and Military Families in the Anti-Iraq War Movement. And it's a really a good book. And Lisa is an assistant professor of sociology at Hendricks College in Conway, Arkansas, and director of Project Pericles. We'll ask her about that. Her research focuses on identity and emotions in attempts to address injustice. She has published about veterans' reintegration, gender in war, and militaries, which is really interesting. Postpartum depression activists, which is kind of interesting, and postpartum depression and activists, Middle Eastern feminist, and finding ways to reduce the physical fighting among middle school girls.
Interesting.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
That would be really, really interesting. But this fall, she's going to be moving to a new place. She's going to be assistant professor in the Peace Studies program in sociology at Chapman University in Orange County. Orange County is kind of a Republican stronghold down there, but it's slowly...
Nixon's stomping ground.
Yeah, Nixon's stomping ground. But it's changing, and there's a lot of really good, hardworking people down there that... are trying to change things, and I know she'll do really well at Chapman, so that's good. I want to thank everybody who called about Laurel. She's doing better, but she got a lot to go. She'll be fine, I hope, and she's going to OHSU now for some doctor's care, and she'll be fine, I hope. And we're going to talk with Lisa, and her book is Fighting for Peace, Veterans and Military Families in the Anti-Iraq War Movement. It's a very good book. It's interesting, and I hope a lot of people get it and read it. And I've got a lot of, when I read a book, I put a lot of marks in it on stuff. You know,
it's pretty ratty.
I got it all bent up, and I got things written in the sidelines and everything that we want to talk to you about, Lisa. So welcome to Veterans Voice, Lisa.
Oh, thank you so much for having me here today.
Oh, it's really
I'm
good.
Really
yeah, we've been touching base off and on, so things finally we get it to do it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this. Thank you for reading the book and marking it all up just like any good student should be doing. So that's exactly what I want.
Yeah, I hope a lot of people get it. And,
Me too.
You know, this is really, when you first start the book, it's really interesting. The U.S. military is largely hostile to protest and protesters. That's how you start your book. Go ahead and talk about that.
Sure. So if we think about what the U.S. military has often been asked to do, it has often been asked to quell protests even inside the United States. And particularly at this point of an all-volunteer force, one doesn't think a whole lot of peace protesters or those who are going to be fighting for peace would be intentionally signing up. But, of course, a lot of people join the military for all kinds of reasons, and patriotism comes in all kinds of forms, especially among the peace movement. And so its function has often been, in many ways, opposed to peace, but because it's the war-making machine. And at the same time, I think there's a really great story that is not told as often as it should be of a history of people coming out of the military and thinking deeply about what it means to make peace.
Yeah, I talked to a lot of veterans here in Oregon, and mostly in the East County, West counties of Washington County and Columbia County. And these veterans, they all joined for different reasons, and they all came back with different stories, but basically the same story. And they're trying to justify why they were there with what they did. And it's really, some of them are really having a hard time. And the ones that are having the hardest time are the female veterans. They're really having a hard time. They're more unemployed. They've gotten more divorces.
The fastest growing rate of homelessness.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Fastest homelessness and a lot of alcohol problems in the female veterans. And that is... You know, probably this war than most wars, because there were more women in the war, and they're having such a hard time, Lisa, such a hard time.
Well, and that's actually something I'm really interested in looking at as I move forward, because my background was actually in gender and feminist protest before I started to really get into looking at peace protests.
Wow.
And I can understand why there might be this kind of gender disparity among, if there really are a lot more women across the country who are veterans who are experiencing this comparatively. I would imagine that things like, they were not technically trained in the same way. They were not trained to be infantry soldiers or to be in positions of direct fighting. So that difference in training may very well be a part of this. But it's likely also due to they're not often recognized for their service in the same way as men. And they, even when they go to seek help, they have lots of stories of being dismissed by the VA or by organizations that they've reached out to. So this is, I would imagine that this is going to be something that we're going to need to take a real hard look at for a long time, because we've also got, of course, military sexual trauma, which affects our male veterans as well, but it does affect our female veterans in terms of percentage-wise a little bit greater.
Yeah, that's true. Angie's talked to us about most of what you just said.
And, oh, yeah.
And she knows. Can you talk a little bit about, you talk about the Veterans Peace Movement, and then you talk about the Military Families Peace Movement. So talk about the difference in these two. Because we know Veterans Peace Movement because we do it. But the family peace movement, that is really, and talk about how it got started and
sure.
Just the whole story on that. That your book talks about that's your book.
Yeah, so I was really interested in the way that veterans and military families interacted in the peace movement, because, you know, I think there's a natural connection between us, but of course there's some pretty big, tremendous differences with veterans having had the firsthand experience with war, and families having had this more removed, but still an experience with war. It's a different type of experience to wait for, to worry about, and or to experience taking care of or death due to war. These military families, some of them were parents who, you know, either were veterans themselves or were not. In many cases, they had been peace protesters at various times in their own history, and their children chose a path to go into the military. Others were parents who had been incredibly supportive of American foreign policy, but then became disillusioned for any number of reasons. There were so many, after all, with the Iraq War to begin with, and the many of them also with the war in Afghanistan. The spouses and the children, of course, were also experiencing, you know, this war that just kept deploying and deploying and deploying their loved ones. Of course, it's not unusual to hear about a veteran who's had, you know, 12 deployments these days. So beginning in the fall of 2012, when many people across the country came together to protest the potential of a war in Iraq, Nancy Lesson, Charlie Richardson, met up with a few other people at a Washington, D.C. Protest where they realized the power of saying, don't send my son to war for oil. And, you know, that really turned some heads in a ways that people who were not connected with the military may not have gotten quite the attention from the media that they did. And when they realized that power, they began to do their homework, because Nancy and Charlie are, in fact, labor leaders. And so they drew on what they knew about the labor movement and talked to a lot of friends, examined whether or not there had been military families who got together to protest previous wars. And the first instance that they could find of it was during the Gulf War. And they followed an organization at that time's lead that tried to improve upon what they saw that organization doing. And, you know, they had a press conference that led to phone call after phone call after phone call from other family members who were really disturbed by even the potential for going to war in Iraq. And at various points, the organization grew and grew. At its largest point, it was a little over 4,000 different families. And that's still small if you think about how large the military is. But, you know, it's very difficult, especially for people who are family members of active duty members, to join publicly a peace protest organization, you know, an anti-war organization, because in many ways they would have to worry about whether or not what they said or did would have consequences, potentially very dangerous consequences for their loved ones. But it also meant a lot of individuals were removed from the rest of the military community. You know, as a military spouse myself, I've learned you kind of have to rely on other military spouses and on the military itself for information about where your loved one is, about for just support. How do I get whatever it is, something done with a paycheck or with the commissary or with the millions of healthcare debacles the military has seen over the years.
Right.
Whatever it is, you rely on that community for information and for access. And so when you stand up and say, this is not something I agree with, and when many of the other people who are in charge do agree with that war, you know, it had consequences. Many people were kicked out of family organizations.
Really?
Yeah.
So talk about that. I mean, people whose husbands, like your husband. That's what we need. We want to talk about that because I keep calling Angie Lisa. I don't know. I don't know why. But Angie was wondering. Well, she can ask you about the husband.
Oh, well, it seems interesting that you're a peace activist and that your husband is active duty, and I was wondering what that was like for you, like what kind of aspects did that bring into your life?
Sure. You know, I'm really fortunate to have a great relationship with my husband, but there have been times we've certainly not agreed, and we are much closer to agreement these days, I think, than, you know, we ever were when we were young. I've been a peace protester, and I protested before we began bombing in Afghanistan, before we went into Iraq. I've been a peace protester since the 90s, which, given my age, that means I began to do this when I was in college. When I met David, we were both working at a bookstore, and he was an Army reservist at the time and had just applied to the Navy. This was the summer of 2001, and that fall when we began to date, I had no idea that he had applied to the Navy, because he didn't honestly think he would get in to flight school. And so he didn't mention that, and instead it was, oh, my time in the reserves is about up, I'm going to be a high school history teacher. He got in and decided that was what he wanted to do. And we had long conversations. We broke up. We kept coming back to a couple of things. One, how are we going to live in the same place at the same time?
Right.
I was in graduate school, and that's still something we've struggled with. But we're about to be doing that for good, which is nice. But also, how do we make sense of our different worldviews? And over time, we came to realize our worldviews actually aren't that different. And he had signed up really thinking, and one might say this is naive, but I think I'd like to think of it now more as hopeful.
I think that's really common.
You know, he signed up thinking he was going to do good. And I think in an ideal world, we would have a military that was truly defensive, that would be actually fighting for our rights and freedoms. And unfortunately, that's just not what we've been sending him to do.
Right.
And, he's really struggled as well with these wars.
Now he's getting out, right? I mean, you sent me the information, and you said that David will be getting
last
out.
Last year, yeah. So what a lot of people don't understand is just how long the initial contract for being a Navy pilot is.
I can imagine.
He's just wrapping up his time. So his required time. And he came to a decision that he was not truly a conscientious objector. Did not feel comfortable, making decisions other than staying in and trying and doing his best to do what he thought was right.
Mm-hmm. But he is getting out, right?
He is getting out. That's correct.
Is he going to be in reserves?
That's a good question. At this point, he thinks he probably will. Because he has. But this is a very tough question. He has had 16 years of time in the military.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
not
a
retirement.
Long... Yeah,
it's a little bit of a golden handcuff.
Yeah, that's Lisa.
Angie.
I don't know why I'm stuck on.
You can just call me Lisa too, I guess.
Angie was talking about that this morning. She said, retirement, it's retirement.
Yeah.
It's retirement.
Yeah.
And so
I
want to get back to.
It's freaking up.
Yeah, oh man. I want to get back to your book, because your book,
sure.
Fighting for Peace, Veterans and Military Families and Anti-War War Movement, and it's really interesting. One of the things that you talked about that we jumped on pretty fast, and I'm trying to find it. You were talking about the different veterans movements and you were talking about Veterans for Peace, and there is something, if I can find it. Oh, yeah, here it is. That you were talking about Veterans for Peace, and yep. you said Veterans for Peace leaves open the option of supporting a war, particularly defensive actions taken by the United States or other countries. Mm-hmm. Can talk about that, because that was really
sure.
interesting to us. We've helped these guys, the Veterans for Peace, for a long time. And,
yeah, which I'm also a member of.
Yeah, and Angie's a member of them. And when I read it, I went, whoa, what? Talk about it. Please talk about this.
Sure, absolutely. So the official statements of Veterans for Peace do leave open the option that there could be something that could really, I guess, fall in line with a just war theory, something that would, in fact, leave the situation better. One might say that U.S. actions against Germany in World War II, for example, particularly in light of the Holocaust, although there's a lot of elements to just war theory, and getting into it is only one piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
How you get out and what happens afterwards is another huge piece of it.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So, but in theory, there could be something. Most of what Veterans for Peace has done, however, is to say that the actions that the U.S. has been involved in since they've been active,
mm-hmm.
And this organization, Veterans for Peace, has really been around since 1985, and their work has been to fight a foreign policy that uses the military to create peace, which I think we can see time and time again is not a a useful tactic for
people. Yeah, it's not. Yeah, that's fighting for peace is just, you know, that's just kind of a talking point, and it never works. And mm-hmm. then you talk about the Military Family Speak Out.
Yeah.
Which was very interesting how they got started and their whole movement, which was just so interesting. And Bill and I went to a meeting that had military families and everything, and it was brought up that just because these folks signed up doesn't mean that they don't have the right to speak out. And we kept pushing that and pushing that. And then some of the women, there weren't very many fathers at that meeting. Remember, Bill?
Yeah.
There wasn't very many fathers at that meeting. It was mostly mothers and some families whose sons had been killed in Iraq and everything, and they were all there. And some of the women were saying, wait now, they signed up for this. They signed up for this. You know, they have to do it. They signed up for it. And we kept saying, no. You know, they can protest. They have a right to protest. Yep. And so go ahead.
I was going to say, so one of the things that I tried to illuminate, especially for people who are civilians, was the how the free speech rights of our members of the military really are curbed. And not protected in the ways that they should be. They do have some rights, but they can get in a lot of trouble for speaking out. And in many cases, it was allowed to the civilian spouses or to the parents to speak out. But to have done so as a member of the military could have gotten a person into trouble, at least in terms of prison. At the very worst, or even being sent to a more dangerous deployment or mission. At the very best, things like physical punishments, eating, restrictions on eating, other minor kinds of things that a command can do. The families, however, have in some cases throughout American history also been restricted from speaking. This would have included the family members of those who were POWs in Vietnam, mm-hmm. were tightly controlled. These days there have been a couple of court rulings that have really distinguished the fact that military families are civilians unless they themselves have taken the oath, that they are civilians, and that they therefore can't be held to the same punishments or standards of those in the military. But at the same time, I think one of the things that people forget is that those members of the military have an obligation to not follow illegal orders. And there's a lot of questions about Iraq and whether or not any of the orders were in fact legal, let alone some of the individual missions and other kinds of things that happened there. So our members of the military have restricted speech. I don't think that signing up to the military, though, should negate all of one's rights, and I don't think that our Constitution quite allows for that either.
No, I don't either.
I'm not a constitutional scholar, but
I think you're right. You're listening to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, and we're talking today with Lisa Leitz, the author of Fighting for Peace, Veterans and Military Families in the Iraqi Anti-Iraqi War Movement, and we've been talking about some of the problems that the active duty military has when their families come and speak out against the war. And I was going to ask you, you know, how about did your husband ever get talked to about your activism? Because you know, there's pictures of you on television and in print and in all kinds of things that you were pretty active in the military families movement. And did your husband get any blowback?
You know, I was really fortunate, and so was he, that we did not. I think there's a couple of reasons for that. First and foremost, we don't have the same last name, so not everybody knew that he and I, or that I was his spouse. Mm. And in some ways that protected him. Mm. And that has actually happened also with a number of single parents who don't share the same, or remarried parents who don't share the same last name. They've also felt that they had some protection that way. Some of the other things that I think helped were being in the pilot community, I do have to say, or being in the aviation community is different. It's a little looser. It was pretty common for people to have all kinds of opinions and lives that were not directed always by the military, which is not always the case for all military spouse communities. I have to say, the other things that happened were that David had always told me from the first few minutes of me wanting to be as public as I have been about these things, that should there be consequences for this, and in particular, if they wanted to kick him out for this, mm-hmm. he was always ready to go, that he would, he thought I was doing the right thing by saying what I had to say about the war and by asking people to listen. And so mm-hmm. he was incredibly supportive, and I'm really grateful for that.
Yeah, you're pretty lucky on that.
I know. I know. I've had a lot of friends and people who are also in the movement whose spouses disagreed with them when they spoke out, whose children disagreed with them. And I write about some of that.
Yeah, you do.
And it was so painful for them. And there were divorces over these things. And there were really just sad days for a lot of people. And some parents had children they didn't speak to for years because of this. And sometimes they would find a way to talk about other things. But, of course, you know, when the war is so present in your life, it's hard not to talk about it. And I couldn't have imagined having had a spouse who was less supportive.
Mm, that would just be so horrible.
It would have been horrible. And because it wasn't only, you know, it wasn't only my activist work. It became my academic work, right? True. This is what I did for years. And he read every page of that book multiple times.
Yeah, good for him.
And helped, you know, he was an extra editor, and I feel fortunate to have had him.
Pretty lucky there. You're pretty lucky because we've talked a lot, Lisa. We've talked a lot of veterans whose mm-hmm. families had been against the war and spoke out a lot about it. And some of those said stories that, you know, the commanders or even the guys in there, especially the Oregon National Guard guys, who, you know, a lot of our guys got sent over there, and men and women got sent from Oregon National Guard. I mean, it's just unbelievable how they've did it, how we've got hit by this mess. And they were telling me, the soldiers themselves were saying how when somebody here in Oregon talked out against the war, if it was a family member or something, that, you know, that they got hassled by their buddies, you know.
Yeah.
Tell your wife to shut up, or tell your mom mm-hmm. to shut up. And a lot of that. And since their commanders were all from Oregon, you know, they heard about it too. And so the commanders would go after these guys, you know. And because I can remember.
There was a lot of that.
And a lot of divorces.
And, you know, I have to say there were. You know, there are some incidents that stand out to me where commanding officer, you know, said a few things at parties, largely at parties, which is interesting, just questioning things a little bit, but nothing, I think, because David was also and is an incredibly good member of his squadron. He's always, not only is he a good pilot, but he's also someone who works really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really respected. And so because of that, I think they could kind of put up with me. But one thing I do have to say is during the first deployment that he went on, we were at a halfway point, and I went to, it was the first time I actually got to meet the women in the spouses organization for PFA 41, the Black Aces. And I was next to a woman who was asking me about what I did. And I explained to her what I do. And I explained to her about my dissertation, and which has become this book. And her husband was a one of the more senior officers in the squadron, and she looked at me and she said, when you get back home, will you send me their information? I want to send them a bunch of money.
Really?
you know.
That's interesting.
It was also interesting during during his officer training, he had, you know, Marine drill sergeants who were questioning what we were doing in Iraq. Publicly, you know, by publicly, I mean in front of these new officer candidates, and it was not unusual to hear people say, if not questioning the reason for going to the war at that time, but at least to question the tactics. And you know, I think by the end of the Iraq War, most of the military was opposed to what we were doing there.
Oh yes.
So it's. You know, during that time, there were a lot of people who were opposed to it, and it just took sometimes a little spark, somebody saying something, and mm-hmm. I got to be that spark.
Good for you. Angie had a question about what's going on now that she asked me earlier. Yes, Angie had something that she wanted to talk to you about.
Sure. Please.
Well, I have more of a current events question for you and your opinion about what's going on in the meltdown in Iraq right now. Mm-hmm. And what is your opinion about the link between what's happening there right now and our invasion in 2003? Do you think that those two are indefinitely linked? Because I feel that they are. I pretty much know they are. But I want to clarify for anybody who is questioning that.
Sure. I think there's no question. I think back to 2002 when I was... affiliated with a Middle Eastern Studies program at UC Santa Barbara that I was just taking some classes with and had a new number of the faculty there. And all of them at the time were saying, and most scholars at the time were saying, this is going to create chaos in the region that will last for decades.
Mm.
And I think that what we're seeing in Syria, what we're seeing in so many other places, is this kind of chaos. And as ISIS has gained strength, It's not actually just ISIS. There's a lot of other organizations that are a part of this fighting force against the government in Iraq. And these organizations are in many ways creations of the sectarian violence that we helped to support. And by that I mean we've taken sides at various points in this conflict, and we did a lot of things to cause the breakdown in Iraq by dismantling the military, by clearly favoring one side or the other at different points, by removing political leaders who, while extremely problematic themselves, their authoritarianism actually was much more stable than the extremely problematic people that are currently in place.
Right.
I think there's no question that they're linked.
Yeah, Bill had a question he wanted to talk.
Yeah, I think that the country, my country, is being militarized gradually, and military adventurism becomes more and more acceptable to the public. And this is evidenced by the amount of money and resources that are used by the military and in our military adventurism. And I see that this is a continuing process, and I'm afraid that myself, I'm a Korean veteran, and I'm afraid that war, perpetual war, has become a way of life in my country.
I'm really worried about that as well. I wish I could have ended my book on a happier note.
Yeah.
That was one of the things that I'm an optimist at heart, and and being a peace professor, I really wanted to end on a happy note. And it was, I have to say, I'm so pessimistic about the way that our country talks about war. War has become a solution to almost any international problem.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't use it, we're at least talking about it. And we spend so little money on diplomacy and on other initiatives that would actually encourage peace. And instead, we spend more on our military than the next 26 countries in the world spend. And I think that that's deeply troubling to me.
Yeah, me too.
And I think when I look forward, unfortunately, I don't have good feelings. And one of them I wrote about quite a bit in my conclusion, and that was about how I think the American public has been really removed from war by the all-volunteer force and by the consequences of not having to pay a war tax or other kinds of things of that sort, where there's no visible consequences to the American civilian to war, and that is deeply disturbing to me. That the American public can be opposed to the war, but there's very little consequences for a politician to engage in that war, because it doesn't have the same effect that if you thought your own brother, father, sister, mother might be going to war.
Yeah, you're right. There's not very many people in Congress now that's been in war.
No, there's not.
And they don't send their kids either.
Exactly. And I think the other piece of this that I didn't write as much about, but I think are some similar kinds of trends of being removed as an American from war, are things like the use of contractors, which basically went on steroids during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. We were using them a little bit since Kosovo, but these individuals that are essentially mercenaries of various types, whether they're on the front lines or they're advisors or other kinds of things, we have hundreds of them still in Iraq. And at various points in these wars, there were more contractors on the ground than there were individual soldiers.
Yeah, Bill has a question.
The third thing I think that's removing us from war are things like drones.
Oh boy, yeah. Bill had something he wanted to ask you.
Yeah, how can we bring to the public the idea that we're impoverishing our nation in order to supply a military force to enforce our will in on other people, when our standard of living is being diminished and our amount of poverty in this country is on the increase. And in my opinion, I attribute it to the misuse of our resources by military adventurism.
Yeah.
I wish I had a magic bullet. I would say there that tactics. Any time the economy is brought up, any time people are discussing that we don't have money for education, for healthcare, for whatever it is, we should be asking, but where is that money? We are paying a decent amount of money in taxes, but a lot of it is going towards the military and towards other countries' militaries, quite frankly. We need to be constantly discussing and willing to discuss economic issues because I think that is one thing that, for at least a subsection of this country, is a central concern. The other thing I think we've got to do is we have to, and this is, I think, a problem we've got across the country, we have to be working on programs that build empathy. You know, reading, writing, and arithmetic are great, but if they're used in the service of bad things or hurting people, then I'm not sure I wanted that person to be literate. I'd much rather have someone who's empathetic have those kind of skills. And it really is a disturbing trend to have watched, you know, not only during the Iraq War, but during World War II or other times, the way that the government can create fear of other people and can suggest that people from other countries are bad and therefore we need to kill them and that we don't. We find some people, you know, we'll try to say things like, you know, just nuke them all or something like that. To me, that is just one of the most horrifying things that we can see in this country.
Oh, that's great. That's interesting. I want to ask you another thing about your book here. We don't have a lot of time. You talk about the split that was in Military Families Speak Out, and that was really interesting to me, why there was that split.
Do you mean between the Gold Star families?
Yeah.
Or do you think the... Gold Star Families for Peace was started by a number of individuals who had lost someone in Iraq, mostly parents. And in a short amount of time, what became clear was that Cindy Sheehan was getting most of the media attention and just most of the attention from the peace movement and others. And for a number of reasons, that was problematic to many of the other people who'd been with her at the founding of that organization. I think she would say, hey, I've given up my life to be a protester, and I, you know, that's why I'm getting this attention. And I think many of the others felt that she wasn't always the best face of that movement for a number of reasons. She sometimes would talk about things that she didn't know a lot about, other kinds of conflicts and other things. I think there was also some questions about about the finances of the organization. I don't know enough about that to speak well about it. I just know that there were questions about that. There were, I think, too, the hope was that by creating another organization, they could do press releases and other things that would highlight other people, because the right wing was so upset with Cindy Sheehan and constantly attacked her that if you drew attention to, hey, it's not just her, there are lots of other people who've lost someone in the wars, whose husband has been killed, whose child died. So we could draw attention away from those critiques of Cindy to critiques of the war.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, I was wondering about that when you were writing about that. And we haven't got much time, so could you just end our little interview here, little interview, a lot of people listening, let me tell you, this interview with you of what do you want to say just to end this interview with? What's your...
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, my hope is that veterans and military families will read this book and be inspired to speak out, you know, as we are talking about putting... although he says they're not boots on the ground, I don't know, are soldiers not going to have their boots on the ground that are being advising, that are advising in Iraq? So I hope that the book will inspire people to continue to speak out more, and to realize the importance of doing that. But also I hope that civilians will read the book and understand better the experience of war for military families and veterans. And as we go forward, especially if, as we continue to have an all-volunteer force, it's going to be important for these individuals to speak out. So thinking about it as a member of the peace movement, how do we support individuals who are also facing post-traumatic stress, who are worried about their loved ones abroad and other kinds of things? How do we support those people?
Mm-hmm. That's really good. And I want to say again that your book is very interesting and it has a lot of great points in it. And I do hope that not only the veterans and veterans' family read it, but I also hope, you're right, that civilians read it. And I really hope you enjoy your new time at in Orange County, but it is kind of right-wing. And my wife is from Santa Ana, and she went her undergraduate, her master's degree, and her PhD at UC Santa Barbara.
So, oh, my gosh, so did I. Wow, yeah. This is a nice connection.
Yeah,
I like
yeah,
this.
Yeah. And she's also in charge of her. She's part of her peace studies at her university also. So I really hope you have a good time there. And
well, I hope to connect with her at some
oh,
point.
Yeah, no problem.
I have to say, I've been in Arkansas, so I understand some of the right wing.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, I am looking forward to being part of a peace studies program.
Yes.
And there's some really great other military family activists who are leading MSSO today in Orange County. So
yes.
I'm excited to head there.
And again, thank you very much, and I hope to talk with you later. We've been talking to Fighting for Peace, Veterans and Military Families in the Anti-Iraq War Movement, Lisa Leitz. Thank you, Lisa, very much.
Thank you for having
okay,
me.
Okay, bye. One of the things that we did bring up about her thing in the book that we really questioned, and that was about her statement on Veterans for Peace. And we had, you know, I had problems with her statement, and Bill had problems, and Angie hadn't heard about it before. And that's really, I don't know where she, you know, that was a problem with her. And I mean, her book's great, but like our buddy Brian Wilson said, and he hit it right on the head. You know, Brian's a member of VVAW, Veterans of the War. He's also Veterans for Peace. And he said he wanted to clarify the Veterans for Peace stance, and I'm glad he did. And it says, Veterans for Peace only agrees with military use in case of self-defense, as in an attack on U.S. soil, as opposed to just war theory, which U.S. military does all the time as humanitarian intervention. And she didn't talk about that, and I wish she would have, but Brian makes a good point, that same thing that I was questioning about what that was all about. And Bill and I talked about it, and Angie, like I said, she didn't hear about that. Had you heard about that before?
I was a little shocked about that.
I was really shocked.
I think that's a bit of a lofty statement.
Yeah.
Because Veterans for Peace is clearly an anti-war...
Yes, they are.
...peace activist group, and... I've read their mission statement before, and I never was under the impression that just wars were justified
with
Veterans for Peace.
No, me either. And that's, I was really surprised when I told Bill about that. He said, well, you know, we need to find out what she's talking about. And she made her statement, and I disagree with her statement, but I agree with everything else in her book. It was really good. And I hope that just by that statement that she made doesn't keep people from reading her book. And and Brian's exactly right on that stand on what Veterans for Peace stands for. And I'm glad that he did this, because I didn't know what to say. Did you, Bill?
That's pretty much what I thought.
Yeah, me too. And I didn't have any idea what she was talking about, because VVAW, Vietnam Veterans Against the War, all of the veterans peace movements, you know, have this great, great stand on war, on anti-war. And I just don't think that she really read the Veterans for Peace statement very well. Because I never, like Angie says, you know, she never read into it what she said there, and I don't know. I think it was a problem.
You know what I think that I would like to go into further is the reference to our interests in other parts of the world. Mm. What are our interests in the Middle East?
Yeah, they're doing that right now. If you listen, I've been listening to these warmongers that on the news right now, and they are saying things like national interest or national. Have you heard that too, Angie?
All the time.
Yeah.
Seems to be some kind of key flashpoint.
Yeah, because they're talking, you know, we have our American national interest in Middle East, and I got kicked off of a veteran's Facebook page for arguing with these people about that. You know, they would say these stupid things, and then I would have I'd go look it up and get all these facts and throw it back in their faces, and most of them were non-vets, and it would just it's back and forth thing. And so one of them came up and said 95% of all veterans are conservatives. And I went, whoa, wait a minute here. So I went and looked everything up and found out that, you know, 33-something% are conservative, 20 are Republicans, 29% are around that are Democrats, and most of them are independents. Mm. And so I added up the Democrats and the independents, and it was like 60% or something, you know. So bam, I got back on there, and I said, you're wrong, because according to Gallup poll and all this, that you know, over 60% are not conservative. And so they were quiet for maybe a day, and all of a sudden, here they come again. He says, well, you know that all those polls are skewed, you know. And then I said, well, what about the polls you guys keep throwing at me? Are they skewed? Oh, no, they're not skewed, mm-hmm. you know. And so then I was off because my wife's really sick, and I've been helping my wife. And so then I got back on there, and then they were talking about Nixon. So I nailed them on Nixon, you know. And got my facts and George Bush, you know, more days on vacation than any other president and all this stuff, and so then I didn't hear, you know, I was helping my wife, and so I couldn't get back on Facebook for a while, and so then I got back on and they had blocked me. Mm. They blocked me off their Facebook page. And so I couldn't do anything more on them. And so I want to, you've been listening to Veterans Voice Radio show on KBOO with Angie and Mr. Bill. And we'll be back on July 18th at 9 a.m. And Angie's going to work with Scott,
Olson.
Scott Olson, the young soldier that got shot in I think it was the face down in Oakland.
Yeah.
And,
in the head.
Yeah, got hit in the head, and we're gonna talk with him. Angie's gonna set that up, and we'll talk with him, and that will be July 18th again at 9 a.m. here on Veterans Voice at KBOO 90.7. And there it is. Thank you, Tammy.
Thank you, Tammy.
The end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I've killed my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we won with a saber and a gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? Mexican land. Fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't marching anymore.
June 20th, 2014, Stories from the Streets is a groundbreaking celebration at Pioneer Square in Portland, Oregon, dedicated to exploring the life of hip-hop in the Pacific Northwest. Our mission is to raise awareness on the positive influences and lifelong benefits that hip-hop culture has had on our homeless youth and our community. All proceeds and donations from Stories from the Streets will directly benefit New Avenues for Youth Nonprofit Artist Mentorship Project. There will be graffiti, breakdancing, DJing, and rapping. Artists include Soul Miner, The Resistance, Black Butterfly, Ancient Soul, Mike Crenshaw, Lucky I Am of Living Legends, and DJ Andy Sparks. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. June 20th from 12 to 9 p.m. in Pioneer Square in downtown Portland.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 10 o'clock, time for Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre.